I look at this distinguished group of men that's speaking today. Kind of interesting thing we have Zoll from Arizona State, we have Jaffa from Claremont Men's College, Wittonski, Hoover Institution, and so forth, Pasoni, Hoover Institution, Meiselman, Virginia Polytechnic, and then it just this is Gary North, author and lecturer. And a lot of you are thinking undoubtedly, if you haven't seen it before, thinking, well, it doesn't give you much hope there. This is author and lecturer. You assume I'm functionally literate because it says author and lecturer, but you can't be sure, because for all you know, I might be a sociologist. I'm reminded of a recent fine description, looking over this tremendously impressive group of names here, and then followed by my own, I feel like the featured player in a production of Seven Snow Whites and the Dwarf. It's kind of a humbling experience. I'm going to speak today briefly about controls, some of the historical background to controls, to use that marvelous phrase of H. Rapp Brown, one of the great political theorists of recent time, that controls are essentially as American as apple pie, which is the case, I fear. And then I'm going to go over some of the background with respect to the failure of the professional economists to foresee the results, not simply of the controls, but the extent of the price inflation. And this failure to foresee these events indicates to me a tremendous lack of either theoretical rigor or at least historical knowledge. And the fact of the matter is, it has cost a great number of us dearly because of the fact that the information which the best sources were giving us simply was not accurate information. Let me give you an example. And this is grim. And I don't know what is going to happen, and I don't know if this is the first round of a major panic or if it is just one of the ups and downs of the market, but we are in the midst, as of the last 3 days, of the greatest flight to gold that has taken place in the last, well, certainly since World War II. Since Thursday, the U.S. Double Eagle, which is probably your best example of panic buying, in other words, the Double Eagle, the $20 gold piece, really is the great reflection internationally of panic gold purchases. That coin, which was $180 in December, which was $250 a week and a half ago, hit $300 Thursday, $325 yesterday, and there is some question as if there will even be availability of them on Monday. The British gold sovereign has made not quite so spectacular a gain, but it is now up to $60 per sovereign, and those coins were available at $35 a piece 8 weeks ago. Now this, as far as the small man is concerned, as far as the buying of the average man in the street, both in the United States and in this country, that is your indication of public opinion. Not what Gallup says, really, but you know, people are, in the old phrase, voting with their feet. Well, of course, this time they're not. They're voting simply with their willingness to exchange very rapidly large amounts of paper currencies for the gold coins, the traditional inflation hedges. And it's moving very, very fast. Now, maybe peaking temporarily. This does happen from time to time. It happened last July. But I am really convinced at this stage that this is a kind of first stage of panic movement out of currencies by small investors, by the little people. Not buying bullion, but buying the only thing they can buy, the coins. In this country, controls came very, very early. In 1629, the good ship Arabella landed in New England and deposited John Winthrop and this small group of Puritans who were to found New England. Now, the Pilgrims had been there for a decade, but they were a kind of backwater colony, remained so. The real source in American history, of much of the American tradition, the New England tradition anyway, did come from the Puritans. They landed essentially in 1628. The great bulk of them hit in 1629, and by 1630 they had passed the first price and wage controls. It took them almost no time at all. They were pulled within a few years They were reimposed. Then they were taken off. This on-again, off-again process went on for at least 50 years in the first years of New England. Again and again, it was noted that it did not work, that it simply was a means of encouraging laborers to move from those towns which did have the controls to the towns which did not. And by, one of the problems was, of course, the shortage of skilled workmen in those early men who came over. They had a lot of farmers, and they had a lot of sons of the gentry, but they did not have any craftsmen initially, and so there was a shortage of craftsmen. It ended, essentially, if my historical research is correct, it ended about 1675, 76, the last great plethora of controls imposed in 1675, 76, with the Great War, and the war most of you have never even considered, but in terms of loss of life, was the worst war America ever had. And that was King Philip's War. They were the Indian chief, and the estimates run between 10 and 15% of all the white population in New England was decimated. And that is a very high proportion of the population to be killed in war, especially in this country. They had one last great round of controls during that war, and after 1676, the controls, for the most part, were allowed to lapse. And you didn't see the reimposition of controls until exactly a century later, in 1776. And with the coming of the Revolutionary War, you saw the reimposition of price controls by the states, not by the central government. They didn't have the authority to do it, but the states did, and they did impose the controls, coupled with paper money inflation, and the result was Valley Forge. Tremendous scarcity of products where the army was unable to outfit itself, even in the most rudimentary form of clothing. Traditional reaction of price-wage controls when coupled with monetary inflation. There was one exception during these years, and that exception was the price of bread, the assize of bread. And I'd like to read briefly from the introduction to the last major push to control the price of bread in New England, which was passed in the year 1720. And it appears in the Acts and Resolves of the Province of Massachusetts Bay. It's one of the really marvelous statements. And it's the preamble to the passing of this legislation begins as follows. Whereas the act made and passed in the 8th year of King William III, entitled An Act for the Due Assize of Bread, is found not effectual for the good ends and purposes therein designed, and little or no observance has been made thereof, but covetous and evil-disposed persons have, for their own gain, deceived and oppressed His Majesty's subjects, more especially the poorer sort, for remedy thereof. And then begins one of the most incredible pieces of legislation of the New England years. I will simply hold up the chart which was made of the assize of bread, and it goes weight of the penny loaf divided, white bread, wheaten bread, household bread, and then within each distinguished, between each division, the ounces and the drams, and then weight of the two penny loaf, and then weight of the six penny loaf, and then weight of the 12 penny loaf, in each case, in the second case, divided between wheaten and household bread, and so on and so forth, for each price, the amount of weight you were to get. Absolutely impossible to enforce this kind of regulation had they even had computers, which they didn't. And it was allowed to die. It did not work, it did not function, and to my knowledge, in my research at least, I have found no more references to the attempt of the good colony legislators of Massachusetts Bay to impose regulation.
What year is that?
1720 is the last reference I was able to find. Now, let us bring it up to the present. August 15th, 1971. Mr. Nixon went on the air on a Sunday afternoon to announce to us that he was imposing for the good of the nation price and wage controls, obviously because some evil and greedy persons had been oppressing His Majesty's loyal subjects, the poor. And then appeared on October 16th of 1971 in Business Week, an article, which was the tip-off. The headline, which should have sent chills and, in fact, paralysis down any intelligent man's spine, the headline which reads simply, Galbraith gives Nixon an A-. And it goes on with the interview with Galbraith to explain why this was certainly a step in the right direction, that Mr. Nixon had certainly done the right thing finally in abandoning the concept of a free price movement. And of course, the results were predictable, exactly the same as when Mr. Galbraith employed Mr. Nixon for the Office of Price Administration during the 40s. Namely, you had a great many shortages. And we are seeing them today. And some of them, of course, are going to be covered later on. What I found in cutting out the literature from most of the public newspapers and economic magazines, three things of the summary of opinion from 1971 really until the latter part of last year: incredibly naive acceptance of the controls, overwhelmingly favorable opinion regarding the controls, and finally, completely wrong conclusions with respect to the controls. Now, I'm going to have a kind of quick romp through the mind of the American leadership in economics very rapidly to go through just briefly what we were hit with. November 22 of 71, Henry Wallack. I am optimist enough to think that phase two will work satisfactorily by and large. Circumstances are favorable, and the goal is not very ambitious, particularly at the upper end of the 2 to 3% inflation range. The upper 2 or 3%. Now, one of the fine articles, if you're going to note it down for reference for kind of laugh a minute almost, Business Week, February 19th of 72, talks about the phase two's backroom boys. And what he points out, that at the point of time that Nixon imposed price and wage controls, there was only one man manning the post, a gentleman by the name of Earl Rode, who did have a bachelor's degree in management, and was, in fact, thoroughly intend to take a master's degree in economics at some later unspecified time. That basically, now, of course, if he'd had 300 computers and programmers, the controls would not have worked any better, but the point is, it was a ragged example of how you impose national policy over 200 million people. And yet even Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, November of 71, we read, an effective system of wage and price controls can reduce inflationary pressures faster than with traditional stabilization policies alone if it succeeds in eliminating expectations of inflation sooner than otherwise. And then, of course, the Great Tightrope Act, a moderate rate of monetary expansion is essential to the maintenance of a rate of increase in the aggregate demand, consistent with the dampening of fundamental inflationary pressures. So between the rock and the hard place, the tightrope walk begins, between enough monetary expansion to keep the economy rolling, but not so much as to increase inflationary expectations. The result was, and one of my favorite articles, Nation's Business, July 72, Nation's Business, a survey of 450 key executives in the United States regarding opinions concerning wage and price controls. 86% of the company presidents, chairmen, senior vice presidents, and economists taking part in their Nation's Business Outlook survey said the economy will improve next year. Nearly 81% said their company's revenues would rise. And then, of course, the magic question, and answer the question how they think wage and price control should continue. What we found is that 83 men said controls should not be extended, and the remainder said leave them on. 83 out of 450. And so, of course, the National Chamber of Commerce, as well as the National Association of Manufacturers, immediately endorsed the president's action with regard to the controls. I'm reminded somehow of that marvelous passage in Lord Jim, where he confronts this rather nubile maiden. And the passage simply says, and of course, applying to the businessmen, he would have ravished her but for her rapid consent. And so over and over throughout the literature, we then had the statement, prediction after prediction, made by the major banks of the company, made by the major government officials, that inflation would indeed be slowed to at the most 3.5% through 1973. Every projection, whether it was from, as I had it from, the First National City Bank, whether we had the president's own prediction, the Council of Economic Advisers prediction in the early part of last year, again and again, 3.5%, 4% at the top. And the result was, depending on whose figures you're looking at, either 5.2% or 6.8% or 8.8%, but it was certainly well above the predicted 3.5%. The result was, as we know, the only people who were fooled by the price and wage controls, the only individuals that I have been able to find whose expectations regarding inflation were lowered, were professional economic advisors of the banks and the federal government. The public apparently was not fooled. And the result has been the worst peacetime inflation that we have experienced for, in my generation. I don't know, some of you other men may remember something worse, but in my time, this is the worst that we have seen. The only people really who were fooled were the professional economic advisors.